You're listening to Death of the Reader. Flex and Herds here for your Murder Mystery World Tour, and we are here in our second week discussing A Dire Isle by R.V. Rahman, chapters 9 to 16, set in Bundelkhand in India.
Bundelkhand, it's a lovely place, so I hear, when there's not dogs, giant spirit dogs trying to eat your face.
Yeah. So, an archaeological dig has gone to chaos. The person in charge was murdered, their body found on a spooky...
A cursed island,
not far out from the dig site, and our detective, Harith Athreya, had been sent there by his compatriot, Liam Dunn, to try and figure out what suspicious things this now murdered individual was investigating before her death.
Yeah, this is kind of the funny thing, right? He's... You know, he's here to solve the murder. He's our detective, but he wasn't actually here initially to solve a murder. And additionally, there's these like Bronze Runner characters running around. Who knows? Who knows what terrible, awful nonsense Athreya will get caught up in by the end of the novel? Besides from getting his feet very muddy.
Well, I mean, you say that. You've ended us here with Harith Athreya and Nazreen caught up.
Yes.
On Naz Tapu with the giant paw print of a dog in front of them just after Nazreen has said something is wrong here.
There's terrible, awful things on the island. Apparently... At least one nasty dog.
A lot of the things that we said last week is still true. It still feels like R.V. Rahman is having a lot of fun writing this story, but we definitely do get into that by-the-numbers crime fiction bit where we're going through our investigation. We're just grilling people.
Well, there are sort of two halves of the story at this point, right? In the middle section.
Yeah.
Because there is the investigation of the characters and the finding of the hard clues, you know, in and around the, you know, the compound and the base of the dig and that sort of thing.
Mm.
But there's also this sojourn, as you point out, that Athreya and Nazreen, they take as they go to the cursed island. And much as we discussed last week, when there's a spooky lady who seems to know everything in a story like this.
Can only go a couple of ways, yeah.
Yeah, you either trust them completely or you do not trust them at all. And Athreya seems to have chosen the former.
The interrogation part of this novel is like forgivingly short and surprisingly dense.
Yeah.
You know, we go over the same few minutes of time over and over again.
Mm.
And R.V. Rahman does not... withdraw from putting the inconsistencies right in your face, and it's so much fun.
It's not a novel that messes around, right?
You know, Adira comes in and basically starts fessing up to things that no one was accusing her of, including like flubbing her university exams. And then, you know, Nazreen comes in and just knows everything.
She hears everything, apparently.
Yeah, Madhav, like, I don't know. He just comes in and it's like he has a pistol in his hand and points it at the floor and he goes, "Now Athreya, bang, my foot."
Nah, I love Madhav. I love how he's just constantly extremely suspicious.
Yeah.
But what we can accuse him of, I'm sure we'll find out in the third part.
We will.
And additionally, we learned that MM is not absolved of crime either, despite being the deceased. Apparently she's been stealing the work of her fellow archaeologists, so those who like work underneath her.
Yeah, she's like supposedly quite well off that we even get into her like accounting history at one point, which I mean, R.V. Rahman,
which of course
is showing his colors.
Mm-hmm.
We get into how she used to be an academic and it almost seems like she kind of went on the run from academia because people were starting to know her for stealing other people's work, like taking credit for other people's research.
Exactly. Yeah, it seems like she started off with a kind of shaky career, and now she doesn't tend to work with the same people again, because as soon as someone gets to know her, she has to move on.
It's just a long chain of burned bridges. Yeah,
it's kind of an interesting character trait to have, to just be the person. I mean, it's the perfect subject for a murder mystery, of course. The person who nobody likes so much that you don't keep them around, right?
Pretty much everyone at some point in their interrogation goes, "Well, you know, like, I didn't like her a lot, but I do feel a little bit sad."
But not really, like,
she's just a corpse for the sake of the plot.
Yeah, I mean, as we've said many times, like, this is an entertaining novel, but it is blunt.
Yes, yes.
We know that Miss Markhan is dead and that she is the subject of the murder, and there are more important things than going into her personal life. We're more interested in her professional life.
We go through and it's like, oh, who's her next of kin? Who's the will going to go to?
Yes. Well,
and it's like, well, she has no relatives here and no relatives here. She's like basically a nobody. And then the only person we get to is, it turns out that Pratap is like her nephew. And it's like,
yeah,
instead of going, oh, well, this poor boy having to deal with his blood relative dying, it's like, well, that's obviously motive.
Mm-hmm. He probably killed her. Damn right. Nah. He matters for the scene that he's in to establish that he exists, but then he doesn't really matter until he's established, you know, as the nephew, right?
Yeah,
like, he matters for his place in the mystery, which is directly contrasted with a character like Nazreem, who we're obviously supposed to like, at least to some degree, or Mopria, who gallantly gets her own feet completely caked in mud for us. Like, all these characters who really have like less directly to with the mystery, I suppose.
Yeah.
But are more the, you know, I mean, they're the compatriots of Athreia. They're the people that are helping him kind of solve the crime.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously we're supposed to like them more. But clearly Avi Rahman does not want us to empathize with the other side of the table quite as strongly, I think.
On that note of like separating characters out, we like split the cast and we have Inspector Bhupinder, and there was this just fantastic moment where Athreia basically says like, oh yeah, you just go interview all the characters that don't matter for me.
Yeah. He's great. I mean, you got to have your bumbling police officer. Like,
but he's not bumbling. That's the thing.
I know,
thing,
but
he's shown to be like area. Really competent. And there are occasional moments where he'll be like, oh gosh, why didn't I think of that?
Mm.
But it's moments where he's like doing the right thing and Athreia is like, but you could be doing better.
I was going to say, he also doesn't have the same like groundwork that Athreia does. He doesn't have a ghost girl guiding him.
Yeah.
He can only do the best with what he's got. It's not like they're on the same playing field.
Yeah. It's just really funny because I remember in particular this one moment where they reconvene after doing their interrogations. Athreia of the main cast and Bhupinder of the other staff who work on site, like the cook and the security guards and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And Bhupinder comes back in and he says, well, we got nothing of worth from them.
Yeah, it's such a shame. Poor Bhupinder. I hope that we see him in a future novel and he's much more present.
The one thing that did kind of rub me the wrong way, though, is that there's a point in the novel where Athreia talks to some guy over the phone in Delhi and sends him this information to get this confirmation back. Why is this completely faceless character in Delhi, you know, taking a position that Bhupinder could have?
Yeah, well, clearly he can't ignore it because his interest is in financial crime. Like, it's all over.
Yeah.
Even though this is a traditional, you know, mystery novel, it's got modern methods of, like, you know, communication with people. It's a big part of the business that he's interested in. He's obviously trying to use the, like, isolated nature of the cursed island and the jungle and all, you know, lost civilizations, that sort of thing, to like distance ourselves from the modern world.
Yeah, yeah.
But to cut it out entirely, I think would just not be his style.
It's interesting because on the one hand, it does show like Athreia's resourcefulness. You know, he does have these contacts.
Sure.
But at the same time, when you have sidelined Bhupinder, who is an interestingly compelling character just because he's like part of the fun of the novel, that's the overwhelming feeling. Why couldn't it have been his contact?
It's not that dissimilar from when we read Sherlock Holmes and we say, oh, I need to get a hunting dog to sniff out the crook. I'll go down to the local guy who owns the dogs and I'll ask him for help. But as you say, because we're not physically going to the dog house, which where you get your dogs, it is a bit dissociating, I think.
Although that said, aside from this complaint, which is minor, I did love that the way that he confirms that what Bhupinder is doing is useless is by basically saying that the gate on the like house that the help are in would just screech so loud that it'd be impossible for anyone to not hear it.
Uh-oh.
He's like, put a tamper evidence seal on the people not relevant box.
It's very sad. I feel bad for them.
So funny.
Honestly, good grief.
I was kind of hoping that there'd be a moment in the story where like someone opened the door and like everyone's head whips to look at it, but it just doesn't happen.
No, I mean, he could have demonstrated it, right? He could have said, okay, I'm going to open the gate, listen for any strange noises that you might hear. But no, we don't get quite a clowning on Bhupinder.
Anyway, let's wrap this part of the discussion here. I have to come back and pose my theory. I'm still sitting on a bit of a fence here, but I got to make my decision today.
I'm looking forward to it. I'm looking forward to you earning your 3 potential points. theory. I assume you're going to pose a different theory today, because the last one was rubbish. Let me be honest. It was nothing even close to the truth in there. So
I'm sure you have many salient criticisms to make about it.
Of course I do.
You're listening to Death of the Reader. We are discussing R.V. Rahman's A Dire Isle, chapters 1 to 16, and we'll be back with more of that in just a second. You're listening to Death of the Reader. We are talking R.V. Rahman's A Dire Isle, and we're joined this week on the show by the man himself to talk about his work, taking a deeper dive into both the world of his corporate thrillers and the joy of Harith Athreya's modern-day golden age detective work. R.V. Rahman, welcome to the show. It's so good to have you.
Thank you. Entirely my pleasure.
Now, we have R.V. Rahman on the show both this and next week, and we wanted to spend this week talking about the corporate side of R.V.'s writing, because we think it's kind of fundamental in a way to understanding his journey towards Harith Athreya. So let's jump into that. Your 2014 debut novel, Fraudster, is a corporate thriller revolving around banking and financial fraud with a lot of technical jargon involved. How did you manage the risk of writing on a topic that historically could just as easily excite as put audiences to sleep?
Yeah, let me just go back a little bit. I started experimenting with writing with fantasy. I did that. And then after some time, and I got the confidence, I wanted to get into crime fiction. I wanted to start with a traditional mystery, but I didn't have the confidence to actually pull one off, as a traditional mystery is difficult to write. Thrillers are easier. And when I looked at what thriller I should write, I went to what was most familiar to me. I'm from the corporate sector. I spent 3.5 decades there. Banks, I know reasonably well. So banking fraud is something which is evergreen. It happens almost every month in India, at least. So I just picked that up, and there was nothing in the market. My biggest challenge there was to take, like you said, the technical jargon and dumb it down or make it more simple. You have a problem there, because if you want to resonate with some of the corporate types, you need to use their language. But on the other hand, for lay readers, it's quite a challenge. And even as it stands today, we are in 2014, we don't have another banking fraud book in the Indian market.
Speaking of that balance, you kind of utilize the human element of financial crime to keep your stories interesting. For example, Varsha loses her father, who was just 2 weeks from retirement, and the tragedy of Shruti, who is manipulated and killed because of her potential rather than anything she concretely did to harm the fraudsters. Do you find that that tends to help draw out and I guess facilitate the technical jargon by keeping that human element in there?
Yes, certainly. I could have chosen to write a purely white crime, white collar crime based novel. But when I started writing, I figured that you have to keep other people interested as well. And that's why I brought in the murder. So all my four of the corporate thrillers is a combination of white collar crime and a murder. Now, Fraudster is also being adapted into a movie. And the change that I'm seeing is what you just referred to. The human element is much larger now in the script of the movie. And the white-collar crime is a little smaller. That's because the average Bollywood audience will not relate to some of the technical stuff. But we have preserved the core of the fraud, but the human element is much, much stronger now.
Has it been like an interesting experience for you returning to Fraudster for its adaptation after all of these years and kind of reflecting on how your own writing has changed since then?
Oh, yes. I think my writing has changed very significantly, both from a language perspective as well as a structure perspective. One of the things that I would probably do in Fraudster if I were to write it again would be to make the ending a lot more concise, shorter. Now I find that most of the current day readers, which is different from, let's say, my generation, they want something to end quickly and end on a high, and they don't want a drawn out explanation. That is something I would have avoided if I were to write it again.
Now, the characters in Fraudster, they seem to have their homes nearly constantly invaded by outsiders. It almost creates this sense of horror. What's compelling to you about the modern fear of criminals having easy access to even the most secure locations of our homes and businesses, Rahman?
Well, it is a reality, isn't it? It's especially in a highly crowded place like India, where security is not as strong as in some other places. It is a constant fear. If I were to leave home and go away for a week, the kind of arrangements I have to make sure that nobody comes in, is a lot. And I don't think this was the case during my childhood, for example. So now it is a lot more difficult. And that threat is there at the background, I think, at every turn, be it in the corporate world or in the personal world.
We were mentioning earlier on a similar note that the modern world and structure of business has gotten so complex with all of these procedures and things you have to do preparing for going away, for example. Do you think that getting in touch with all of those and understanding how to put them into a corporate thriller helped prepare you for the intricacies of murder mystery when you finally got to do a classic Golden Age detective style novel?
Yes and no. There are some elements which certainly prepare you for that, but there are some elements which are the deep technical ones. You want to at least I want to have a traditional mystery of in the vein of the Golden Age, but with realism in terms of technology today. So there are some parts, for example, WhatsApp. Understand using that as a communication channel certainly it helps prepping the reader. But some other elements that you may see in Fraudster, and if you go on to the other books, Insider, etc., those things do not have a place in the traditional mysteries.
In Fraudster, there's to move away from the digital side of things, there's a lot of what I like to call faceless goons or thugs. They're kind of running around doing the bidding of their evil corporate overlords. They're sometimes very efficient, but often very incompetent. Is incompetency at key moments sort of the most important ingredient of a good thug character, do you think?
Yes, I think so. And again, it's very different depending on the kind of thug you might use. There is the suave, sophisticated thug who you can't, you know, incompetence doesn't come. The guy is really, really smart. But some of these thugs who are entirely physical in the threat that they give. Incompetence not only gives us an opportunity for the protagonist, but it also gives opportunities for humor, which I'm not very good at.
It's okay. I think it carried through. I think one of my favorite details about the thugs was how often you'd have to indicate, you know, they have an earpiece in, they're getting instructions from the person behind the scenes. And this can kind of lead to them misunderstanding instructions or acting on their own and kind of screwing things up.
It's definitely something at least I still see in like Madhav as a character, in that he so often comes in and he's not like entirely the thug archetype, but he does make some pretty incompetent seeming mistakes.
Yeah.
Now, these mistakes that they make, if they help the protagonist to solve the crime, which he hasn't really spent deducing, then it's a kind of an easy way out for the protagonist. So you don't want that. But at the same time, where it's purely physical, it's fine. You can do that. And to some extent, since the first four books were written for the Indian audience, right? There is a certain stereotype that you see in the movies. It's easy for my audience to relate to. That's one of the reasons why I use them. You will find going forward that in my books, the thugs come less and less, especially Die Rael. I don't know if you read Will to Kill. There isn't an incompetent thug there.
I mean, they're a staple of the genre for a reason, aren't they? They're my personal favorite kind of character, just ahead of the romantic love interest that secretly is a cold-blooded killer. That's another good genre archetype. Now, anyway, based on an old interview that I've dug up on the internet from 2014, I understand that you're a man who's more interested in principles than in rules. Now, detective fiction is famous for having far too many rules. How has your attitude helped you on your journey to becoming a detective fiction master?
I think as a person, I tend to view things more from a principle viewpoint, even in my professional life. So the same thing I carry forward to the detective as well. They come from ab initio, from first principles and principles basis. And if I look at the theme behind some of these stories, again, it's a question of reiterating principles. In Fraudster, the amount of crime that happens in the corporate world and people get away with it is huge, number one. Second, you have the unfortunate bystander or unfortunate collateral damage happening, which again is anchored in some kind of a principle of as a person, I might think that this is fair, this is unfair. And I see a lot of these unfair things happening in the corporate world. So I think that comes from the principle there as well.
Thank you to Avi Rahman for joining us here on the show this week while we discuss his novel, A Dire Isle. We will have him back to discuss full spoilers all the way through all the juicy secrets next week on the show. So make sure you get subscribed to the podcast for that, or tune in next week if you're listening on 2SER 107.3. This is your Murder Mystery World Tour, Death of the Reader, and we'll be back with more in just a second. You're listening to Death of the Reader. Flex and Herds here for your Murder Mystery World Tour. We are discussing R.V. Rahman's A Dire Isle, chapters 1 to 16. It is time, Herds, for me to pose my solution. Last week on the show, I said that I thought that M.M. Markin had been killed.
Miss Markin.
Because she was a bronze runner.
Which she is, and clearly.
That Madav had been investigating her, had been cordoned on to, and he was trying to stop her getting ahead of the investigation.
Sure, sure.
And I pointed out a few other bronze runners.
Before you say what you're going to say, I want to point out there are 3 points available here. I'm going to lay down what you're getting points for. One, I would like you to highlight the murder, the murderer, the who, how, and the why as usual.
Yes.
For the second point, I want you to identify any and all bronze runners that exist in the story currently.
Do I have room for error?
No. If you miss even one, you will lose down a point. Yeah. The third point, now, Athreya isn't actually here for a murder, as I pointed out several times. He's here to investigate.
Wait, hold on. No. I need one more clarification on the bronze.
What's the clarification?
If someone is involved in the smuggling of goods, but not part of the bronze runners, and I name them.
I just need you to tell me who is a bronze runner. If there is one, name them. If there are none, say none. Oh, name all the bronze runners.
Okay, because the thing is, Jagan, I don't know if he's a bronze runner, but he's obviously participating in their running.
I don't know. It's up to you. You have to figure it out. Figure out if they're a bronze runner.
Oh my gosh, that's
vicious. The second point. It is vicious.
Vicious.
The third point is vicious. Because, as I've said, now this is a murder mystery show, and I'm sure that the fans will, I'm sure that everyone will cry foul, but Athreya is investigating financial crime. I want you to figure out who, if anyone, is doing a financial crime today. Those are the three prongs. So the actual murder, identify the bronze runners, and who's doing financial crime. Those are the 3 points I'm going to hand out today. Good luck.
That's so tough.
It is.
Because let's start with the last
one. I think entirely fair.
Because Dr. Corder has effectively been caught doing financial crimes.
Mm.
But in asking that question, I assume there's a twist that I haven't seen coming there.
Who knows?
Oh, dear. Oh, no.
I tried to pick out the best questions I could possibly pick.
Okay, let's just put this to you listening at home in case you haven't been reading along.
Uh-oh, I'm scared.
We found that Adhira and Dr. Corder were the ones in charge of the funds, and that there was a discrepancy between their documents where Dr. Corder was putting in something that totaled to like 53 of whatever the currency was into a third account that we hadn't found.
Mm.
And I'm assuming that by asking that question, there's probably a way to figure out where and whose that third account is.
Maybe.
My immediate assumption would have been Markin, but because she asked Dunn for an investigation, and there is a difference between hiding in plain sight and inviting scrutiny.
Inviting the wolf into the hen house, as it were.
Yeah. So that is a challenge. All right. I'm gonna have to sit and think on that for the episode, but it is a good transition into the other thing that I wanted to talk about.
Sure.
Which was my solution from last week.
Yeah, let's jump into that.
I think I was pretty on the money last week. I just want to flip around some character roles, as I said I might have to do.
Sure. So this will take 30 seconds and then you walk away with a point. Easy breezy.
Yeah. So I think that Markin had probably found the Bronze Runner stash and was catching on to them, and that's why she was killed, and that Madav is probably one of the Bronze Runners. I think that he is double-crossing whoever is asking him to investigate. And the reason I think that is because you stopped this just after a new name drop of someone who'd been contacting Madav called Kanai?
Yes, Kanai, I believe is how it's pronounced.
Madav walks into the interrogation, completely shoots himself in the foot, makes it very obvious that he's up to something. Because think about how effective that is. If Madav is investigating but also double-crossing the people he's investigating, then when people look in deeper to him, they're going to find the investigation and stop.
So it sounds like you're you're accusing Matt of being the killer. Is that correct?
I'm going to go with yes.
Okay, sure.
I'm relatively confident that he is at the very least the one that carried her body to the island, because he just completely blabs his mouth about that and has information that he in no way should have been in proximity to. He's like, oh yeah, you know, I just heard it around the place when he only just happened to show up like 20 minutes ago.
I do want to throw a spanner at you. Obviously, like,
please,
we've been to this island, I think, a couple of times now at this point in the novel. And obviously, you know, Nazreem has brought us here. What about this paw print? We found a paw print on the island and Nazreem seems like extremely worried traveling to her island, which, you know, what's going on there?
She's obviously seeing something she doesn't expect to see. I think that that's probably just a setup in the same way
Is she terrified of a large half dog, half, let's say, cockroach monster that roams the island? Is that what's going on there?
No. I think that she just knows the story, and much in the same way that Priya asks, what kind of creature leaves no footprints, when the solution is obviously that there is only one set of footprints? So I think this is just part of the show by whoever's trying to continue the misdirection amongst the Bronze Runners.
No, I like it. So it sounds like you're pinning this on Madav as a Bronze Runner, and he's killed MM.
Yeah. So my Bronze Runner list, to remind you from last week, is Mitali, Ulhas, Madav, Jigan. As I said, I'm just going to pin him because he's obviously involved in smuggling of goods, even if he isn't one of the Bronze Runners.
Sure.
And then I'm really torn on Pradap. Like,
he's a fun character.
He's obviously got a bit of financial interest in being there. You know, he's going under another name. Oh, which, by the way, Madhav had been at other sites going under another name, which is yet more reinforcement for the fact that he's running around the country with fake identities.
Sure.
But Pradav's been going under his middle name rather than his first name, so that the connection wouldn't necessarily be noticed. It's like a little suspicious that MM never mentioned that to anyone. Like, I want to say that maybe she didn't even know him, like, personally, and that he is, through that family connection, taking advantage to feed information to the Bronze Runners or something along those lines. I'm gonna go with, yeah, he's in the loop.
So your Bronze Runner list is Mitali, Ulhas, Madav, the Jagan, is it?
Jagan.
Jagan, that's the one. And Pratap, those are your Bronze Runners. Okay, cool.
My in the gray area fence, I'm still suspicious of Dr. Corder, but my expectation is that his embezzlement of funds is probably for another reason, because I feel like,
okay, sure,
you know, if they're as successful as they're alluded to be at stealing goods and fencing them off, then they probably don't need the extra source of income and paper trail.
And speaking of financial fraud, you think that Dr. Corder is the only person doing financial fraud here? Do you think that he is that character?
I don't have any solid evidence to pin anyone else. Like, your question is honestly the only thing that's made me enormously suspicious that there may be a broader financial scheme. Yeah.
I'd be suspicious.
But, you know, honestly, I'm gonna take a dive in and say maybe it's just as straightforward as it seems. I doubt it.
Okay.
I doubt it, but I'd also be clutching at straws, and
okay, sure.
I'd feel bad if I guessed my way into an answer on this one.
That's okay. All right, so lock it in. Lock in your answers. You got the murderer, the Bronze Runners. We've discussed the Bronze Runners. And for financial fraud, who are you locking in? You're locking in Dr. Corder and no one else?
I'm going to go with Dr. Corder.
Okay, sounds good.
I'm feeling pretty confident about this novel, because it's so easy to sit one or the other side of that line on who is the Bronze Runner and who isn't. It's like really easy to see a lot of what's going on in this novel, but not to get a final clear whole picture.
Sure.
And that is a really compelling way to do a puzzle in a novel that you won't be able to get the full extent of.
Yeah, sure.
It's like a very clever way to play the murder mystery game efficiently as an author without dissatisfying a reader, I think.
I definitely have more thoughts about the mystery for next week. But yeah, I think that's, you've hit the nail on the head, as they say. There are many different aspects to the crime and many crimes to be accused of in this story. So I think that no matter who you are, if you spot anything in the novel that seems the slightest bit suspicious, you'll probably walk away with a bronze trophy.
Nice.
I'm terrible. Good grief. Well, I think that'll about do us for this week's discussion.
Fantastic.
Of A Dire Isle by R.V. Rahman. And of course, next week we'll be doing chapter 17 to the end.
That's the ones.
Of A Dire Isle, starring Harith Athreya. You'll listen to 2SCR on a 7.3.